Good evening, everyone. Thank you for coming. Thank you for praying. Those of you that it occurred to pray, thank you for that. I think I had had a hard time finding time to study for this topic. I just couldn't get started. I knew it was coming up. I had plenty of warning, but I just couldn't get started when I wanted to. But I did take a few hours off this morning where I was able to study some, so I'm not exactly sure why we did 1 Peter 5 last time, and we're doing 1 Peter 4 this time. I don't need to know that. I just do as I'm told. So we'll go through 1 Peter 4 this evening. I thought in studying this, it almost seems like Peter is wanting to emphasize the Christians' need to lead a godly life through this chapter. He's just emphasizing it over and over again. Another thing that struck me was he speaks a lot about suffering, and he speaks about the blessings. We know that God created night and he created day, and sometimes we have night in our life and sometimes we have day in our life, or light. And I was reminded recently that it seems like at night or during those night times, the problems always seem worse at night for some reason. And recently we went on that father and son's canoeing trip, several of us, and we had a pretty good time. If you want to know about turtle egg omelets, talk to Joy. I don't know if anybody else had the nerve to actually taste them, but I know he did. But anyhow, we paddled all day, and then we pulled over on a sandbar to camp at night. And of course, we didn't have any light. And so when the sun went down, we had our beds made, and we were ready to go to bed when the sun went down. Well, I had forgotten to pack a flashlight, and this worried me a little bit because it wasn't all that bright of a moon either. So I mentioned it a little bit, and Larry Byler very kindly said he had an extra flashlight, and he loaned it to me. So I went into my tent and went to sleep fairly quickly, and I was woke up, and it was pretty warm night, so I had, shortly thereafter, shed most of my clothes. And about the middle of the night, I woke up, and there was this great, big, horrible thing crawling across my chest. And my first thought was, you know, a spider, a tarantula, maybe, or a scorpion. It wasn't a very good feeling, but I was able to reach out and grab that flashlight that Larry had loaned to me, and of course, the first thing I did was swat it across there, and the thing flew over against the tent. Got the flashlight, shone it on it, and it was nothing but a big, fat, harmless June bug. But it felt much worse. But I was just reminded that when we let the light shine on things that happen to us during the night, it is always and immediately better. He speaks a lot about suffering in this chapter. How could we ever blame God for allowing us to suffer in fairness? Because if we would single out the sufferings to blame him for, we would also, in fairness, we should make a list of the blessings that he gives us. And it would only be fair to, it's only fair to take the one with the other, and all to the glory of God. In thinking about this, Peter's urging for us to walk the walk because of those that used to be our companions in sin, as a witness to them, I came across this little story here, and I think I've heard it before here, so you may already know it, some of you, but I thought it fit in. two men from the gas company. They were out checking meters in a suburban neighborhood. At the end of the alley at the last house, the woman was looking out of her kitchen window, watching the two men as they checked her gas meter. When they finished, the older man challenged his younger co-worker to a foot race back to the truck. As they came running up to the truck, they realized the lady from the last house was huffing and puffing right behind them. They stopped and asked her what was wrong. Gasping for breath, she replied, "When I see two men from the gas company running as hard as you two were, I figured I'd better run too." The world is watching us, and if they see a reason in our lives, if they sense an urgency, a seriousness, we can influence them to seek that also. As we go through this, I'd want you to feel free to just share any thoughts you might have or comments. I really don't know which passage to pick out. I have a few that I picked out myself, but any one of these could, we could spend a lot of time in any one of these verses. So if you have something that's on your mind, we'll talk about that. Starts in verse 1. It speaks about the mind of Christ. Arm yourselves likewise with the same mind. Recently I had a thought about that. We were studying that passage where it says, "Greater love hath no man than this, that he lay down his life for his friends." And I have long, whenever we came across that passage, I would think, well, that's not quite true. It would take a greater love to lay down your life for your enemies than it would for one of your friends. But if we look to the example of Jesus, he didn't have any enemies. He created all men and they were all his friends. And so if we arm ourselves with the mind of Christ, we also don't have any enemies. For he that hath suffered in flesh has ceased from sin. Then it goes on and speaks about the pastime of our life, which we have wrought the will of the Gentiles when we walked in. And it mentions the different sins there. And then it speaks about after we become Christians, why do they speak evil of you? Does anybody have a thought on why that would be? Why should they even care? Or do you have a thought on anything in the first part of the chapter so far? For he that hath suffered in the flesh hath ceased from sin. Let's have some thoughts on that. If you want to, Paul, you can go ahead and share what you've got.
I'm wondering if this is sort of a proverb that and brings us to the realization of
there are different kinds of suffering here that it could mean. Ali?
How much difference is it from the first part of the verse, which refers to Christ, of course, instead of us? For as much then as Christ has suffered for us in the flesh, arm yourselves likewise with the same mind, for he that has suffered in the flesh has ceased from sin. Does that, it seems to me that helps me understand it a little, that first part.
It's mentioned in the same verse, so it could mean the same type of suffering. Nathan?
Is it not true that if we give ourselves, lay our lives down in order to benefit others, that then we are no longer thinking of ourselves? And verse 2 becomes true of us. Mm-hmm. I think ourselves are living according to the will of God. That is the problem.
Those who willingly suffer for the cause of Christ find it easier to resist sin and to follow God's will. They have united themselves with Christ and shared in his cross. As a result, the pull of sin is made insignificant and the will of God paramount. That's a footnote I have here in my Bible. If we obey God when it means suffering, ridicule, or rejection, somehow that strengthens the believer morally and spiritually, and he will receive a greater grace. We need to look no further than the martyr's mirror to see that principle in the lives of many that are mentioned there. Okay. Anything else in verses 1 through 3? We could talk a little bit about the different kinds of suffering, I guess. I made a list here. It's probably not a complete list. Christians can experience suffering as an ongoing consequence of the fall. That would probably be the most widely spread one. When sin entered the world, pain, sorrow, conflict, and eventually death invaded the lives of all human beings. Also, Christians may suffer as consequences of their own actions. The law of sowing and reaping applies in a general sense to everybody. If we drive our cars recklessly, we will probably have an accident and we will suffer physical pain. Or if we are undisciplined in our eating habits, we will probably suffer some health issues later in life. So some of the suffering we could bring on ourselves. Christians also suffer because they live in a corrupt and sinful world, and all around us are the effects of sin. We experience distress and anguish as we see the power that evil holds over so many lives. That can cause suffering. A couple more. Christians can suffer at the hands of the devil. We have the example of Job, and we also have the example of the woman that had an affliction for 18 years. That Jesus healed, and he said that Satan has bound her 18 years. And God may use suffering in our lives as a catalyst to spiritual growth or change, or to test our faith. And the last one I have is that God uses suffering of the righteous to further the cause of his kingdom, maybe for no reason that we can even explain. And we would look to the example of Joseph for that. God meant it well. Joseph's brothers meant it for evil. And Joseph suffered through it. Just a few thoughts maybe as we go through this. And there are many different kinds of suffering that might apply here. Can we always know? I like verse 19, if that question comes up. Wherefore, let them that suffer according to the will of God commit the keeping of their souls to him in well-doing as unto a faithful creator. May not be the most important thing. If we know that God is, that we are living, suffering according to the will of God. Yes, Gary. Lowell, did you have your
hand? Marvin was asking here about what, how do we decide what for the suffering and what kind is it? Talks verse 15, but let none of you suffer the murderer or the thief or the evil or the busy by the body and other men's matters. There's suffering that comes as a consequence of a person's wrong decision. Peter is like you said, don't go there at all.
David. It's also a good illustration for verse 8. Charity shall cover the multitude of sins, in that they were able to make peace and overlook these things in a personal way. David.
Like to know why, and of course, it's
we have the mind of Christ, then in the midst of those, in the midst of any suffering, we will still know that God is in control. I especially thought about that about a week ago. We went, Mike and I went to Ludington, Michigan last week. We went for a little fishing tour. And there's a little community there of, they used to be our Amish friends and neighbors in Bloomfield, most of them, so we knew most of them. There's only 8 families there right now. We were there last Thursday, and Thursday evening, we were spending time there, and one of the young families that lived there had 4 boys, 4 little boys, and the father had just finished building a new pond out in front of the house, and it was a really a steep, he made it for a little recreation pond, and he made the sides really steep up to a certain point, and then he leveled it out for a nice swimming area so it would be safer. Well, he didn't realize, but he had built his pond in a spring-fed area, and quickly this filled up to the steep part, was full, and then it kind of stopped. The flat, shallow area wasn't full of water yet. Thursday night, his 2 oldest boys fell in, slipped in, and drowned while we were there, and we got the word there where we were with Leo's. They were 9 and 7, and they couldn't find these boys, you know, right away. And so the father remembered seeing an inner tube out on the pond, so he got the feeling that it wasn't all quite right. So he went down to the pond and started looking. Couldn't find them. Finally, he took his clothes off and dove into the water, and immediately came up in 8 feet of water. He came upon the oldest boy and brought him back out. But the thing that struck me, and then he said, there was a friend there with him, and he said, you have to go after the other one, I can't. And so the other one dove into the water, clear to the bottom, and came right on the second one and brought him up. And the thing that struck me was, in the middle of his grief and his shock, he said it was only by God's his direct pointing that they were able to find those boys on their first time down. If we have that kind of automatic reaction, we probably have, I don't know if I'd have that or not, but that really struck me. That even in the middle of the terrible grief, he gave God the glory for being in his place and doing what he does best. I think that funeral was Sunday morning. And they were going to bury both boys in the same casket. And they said they always were at the same place. Wherever one was, the other one was. They did everything together. And now they died together, and they are definitely in heaven together. So it's just I guess verse 12 speaks about fiery trials. A lot of us haven't went through fiery trials of that magnitude, but we all have fiery trials, or will have. Yes, Marvin.
Analyze the situation and say, this is the reason.
It's not in our place to judge, although that might be the case. Maybe God is sending sufferings for a reason of his own, but it's not in our place to judge. Yes, Paul. As in persecution and physical sufferings due to almost in verses 12 through 14, it almost makes us want to feel sorry for someone that isn't suffering. There's a lot of blessing in it. If ye be reproached for the name of Christ, happy are ye, for the Spirit of glory and of God resteth upon you. Yes, Lowell.
We can talk kind of clearly and theoretically about suffering, but I think for our brothers in the Indians who have suffered, it is not a place. It is very difficult.
Their experience is much more real than we can imagine even here. Yes, Nathan.
Verse 7.
Okay. Sir, yes, David. Someone else have a comment on that verse?
Yes, I like it too, and it introduces then two broad categories of Christian service, which is the speaking and the serving, and both are to be done as God has gifted and God and by God's energy.
Okay. I'd like to back up just a little bit and talk about verse 8 and verse 9 some. Is this in these two verses, is he speaking about Christians to Christians? Or is he speaking about Christians to everyone? He says, have fervent charity among yourselves, for charity shall cover the multitude of sins, and then use hospitality one to another without grudging. Okay. Can you explain that a little further? Yeah, that's kind of what I gathered too. Yes, Lowell. Was that, where was that passage from?
1 John 2.
Yeah. And I have one from 2 John 10. If there come any unto you and bring not this doctrine, receive him not into your house, neither bid him Godspeed. For he that biddeth him Godspeed is partaker of his evil deeds. And I like what it says when it says, use hospitality to one another without grudging. That puts a whole different meaning to it. We can all agree to do the right things, but to do it without grudging might catch us, might trip us up. I was reminded of a story I read a long time ago about Billy Graham. When he was just a young man, he was a circuit preacher. He spent a lot of his time on the road, didn't have hardly any money, and he visited the different outlying churches, and he always tried to put a little something in the offering plate for each one. Well, one church service he attended, the offering plate came around, he had two bills in his billfold. He had a $10 bill and he had a $1 bill. The $1 bill was supposed to go in the offering plate, but by some mistake or whatever, the $10 bill ended up going into the offering plate. He didn't realize it until it was too late. So that evening he was telling his wife about it. He was just carrying on and how he needed that $10 bill and how he couldn't afford to put it in there, and just the way things had went in general. And finally his wife just looked at him and said, you know, it's too bad, because God's only giving you credit for the $1 bill. But it's there's a valuable principle there. Yes, David. I think there's a lot of truth to that. money doesn't mean anything to God. It's the heart. Okay. A few more notes I have here on hospitality. There's a difference. Being given to hospitality is more about the state of one's heart than the state or the size of one's home. There's a difference between entertaining and hospitality. When we think of ourselves as entertaining our guests, we make ourselves the entertainer, the center of attention. Appearances, our own and that of our home, and the food we've prepared then take priority. But true Christian hospitality is focused not on self, but on serving our guests, whom we esteem better than ourselves. Maybe taken just a little bit out of context for what it was meant for here, but those were thoughts that I had when I was studying it. And it doesn't have to take place in our homes either. Where is it written? The account of ye were hungry and I gave you to eat, and ye were thirsty and I gave you a cup of cold water. That was the ultimate case of hospitality, and it took place in prisons and places a long way from our own homes. So hospitality is a much wider ranging term than what we often think. Yes, Joe?
We often connect hospitality to entertaining the people we invite, but the people we don't invite. We live just a quarter mile from Highway 50, and it's not uncommon to have somebody show up who's on foot, needs water or something. Sometimes it's not uncommon for it to be a very strange person that has some really deep spiritual needs. But I welcome those opportunities because it's God hasn't called me to go out onto some mission field. But those are opportunities that he sends right to my door. And I take pretty seriously the responsibility to entertain strangers. There are often people who are in some way seem very helpless. And it's a way of just showing them goodwill, giving them some love, sitting down and visiting.
Yeah, I appreciate that. I was going to ask you if you pick up hitchhikers too.
Generally not.
Some people do. They make a habit of making that their mission. I myself have not found the nerve to do that. Yes, Gary?
Stingy with what he's giving.
I guess I haven't come across that one, but I see. Yeah.
It's a loose translation. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it fits right in with this. So in other words, if the person that is feeding you is begrudging it, it spoils the whole experience for you, too. Yeah. Yes, David.
So to get back to my hanging on to your giving them a ride, there is a story that I think is pertinent. There were two Mennonite ministers, I forgot who the one was, one was John Denver, who was a conservative conference minister, a brother to Mrs. Elam Hotspur. And he and another minister did pick up a hitchhiker. And they had rather pleasant conversation. I don't know just what they talked about. But after the fact, they got a communication from this hitchhiker and said, really, you shouldn't be picking up hitchhikers. He said, I had other plans, but I changed my mind. If you look under the seat, you'll find a weapon, a gun. And they did, and it was there.
I'm guessing they didn't hesitate from picking up hitchhikers from that point on. God had showed himself mighty.
Apparently they made a clear expression that he didn't carry out his plan.
All right. Is there anything else you want to talk about before we close in any of the... anything we haven't touched yet, or... Rejoiced. Okay. Do you have some thoughts on verse 18 especially? I think it's easy to get the picture that that's saying, even if we are right, if we are Christians, we will just scarcely slide under that door before it closes and might even come down on our toe yet as it comes down. But it's not referring to that. It's speaking of the grace and how that is the work that gets us in.
Could we conclude that we should receive grace as a kindness rather than a sense of entitlement? It's not something we have earned or entitled to, right? You just get it and say it.
Okay. I think the last verse is a good one to close on, and I copied that in a different translation. I'm going to just read that off and then conclude with that. So, if you find life difficult because you're doing what God said, take it in stride, trust Him. He knows what he's doing, and he will keep on doing it. Thank you for your input.
Thank you, Marvin. And let's close with singing. Shane?